Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal on the biz page as normal. And under the heading of Cool Park comes the article, Park Featuring Whirligigs Dedicated in Wilson. Wallace Simpson's Whirligigs have long been admired and have attracted crowds of gazers. But the North Carolina Arts Council and the City of Wilson have now made an official destination park out of the colorful creations. The park, dedicated November the 2nd, is located at 301 Goldsboro Street South in Wilson and features 30 large-scale whirligigs created from recycled and salvaged parts. It's an arts-driven economic development project that the state says has already spurred $25 million in private investment in Wilson's historic downtown. The idea of conserving Simpson's Whirligigs began back in 2007. Later, the North Carolina Arts Council and the City of Wilson teamed up to create the Wallace Simpson Whirligig Park, and the Whirligigs began to be relocated to the downtown Wilson area. Simpson himself advised the teams and worked with conservationists during the relocation up until his death in 2013. The collection is now owned by the City of Wilson. And under the heading of Job Growth comes the article, Company Expansion Means Jobs in Youngsville. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Accutech USA expanded its operations in Youngsville, unveiling its new manufacturing facility to the public at a ribbon-cutting event October 31st. In a post on his LinkedIn page, company president Ed Lee said the facility will allow us to develop and manufacture custom linear actuators for our customers. The company had expanded its presence from Wake Forest into Youngsville earlier this year. And under the heading of On the List comes the article, Special Award for This Raleigh Firm. Sally Webb said her friends and family thought I was mad in 1987 when she started an events company in England. My dad said to me, you'll never make a business out of that, she tells Biz, and here we are. The special event company, now in Raleigh, has 18 employees and $8.5 million in revenue this year after $5 million a year ago. And Webb's company was recently named to Special Events Magazine's list of the top 50 global event companies, a recognition that includes revenue growth and industry impact. I was really, really thrilled, Webb says. Webb's company was growing in London, and she often found herself coming to the U.S. to give talks. A Duke University person heard her speak in California, which led to her doing an event for Duke in London. Before long, she was working with basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski. As soon as I started working for Coach K, my business took off, she said. She moved to the Triangle, even met her husband, PGA caddy Grant Berry. Her firm does about 75 events per year, with about 30% of them local, another 50% across the U.S., and 20% across the globe. This has been the most incredible region for me to have this kind of business, she says. I could have seen as a foreigner coming in, but I've brought a lot of experience to the event market. And under the heading Hall of Famer comes the sad news, sports journalism loses a legend in passing of Tudor. ACC basketball season is almost here, and it's hard to believe this will be the first season in decades without Colton Tudor on the sidelines. Tudor, from Angier, rose up the ranks of the Raleigh Times and then the News and Observer as a respected writer, reporter, and editor. His hearty laugh and easy smile were staples on press row for decades, and his columns for the paper and later WRAL Sports Fan were big hits with readers. Tudor entered his career in a world of manual typewriters and yet was perfectly comfortable in the digital era. He was widely admired inside newsrooms where he was happy to share his knowledge and expertise with younger writers. Tudor, who died October 31st, was inducted into the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame earlier this year. He was 70. And under the heading of We'll Take It comes the article, Now You Can Live Like a Jazz Age Tobacco Magnate. If you want to live like tobacco royalty, now is your chance. A 14,950-square-foot home near Winston-Salem that was built for the niece of R.J. Reynolds in 1928 will be auctioned in November. The home was once listed at $2.975 million, but it will be sold without a reserve at an auction November 16th. The auction begins at 4 p.m. The home includes 4.45 acres. Bidders have to put $100,000 in escrow and register with Concierge Auctions. The estate is a reminder of the power and wealth of the tobacco industry in North Carolina in the 20th century. Richard Joshua Reynolds started the firm in Winston-Salem in 1874. And by the time he died in 1918, the company employed 10,000 workers in 120 buildings in Winston-Salem. In 1929, the company built the Reynolds Building in downtown Winston-Salem, and the building became the model for the Empire State Building. Now moving to the On Technology page, we have a couple of large articles here. One is called Wine and Design Feud Spills Over into Court. 5 months after Raleigh's Wine and Design seemingly secured a televised investment on Shark Tank, the deal has fizzled, court documents show. A pair of lawsuits have been filed by Harriet Mills and Emmy Price, the entrepreneurs who founded the Wine and Sip franchise in 2011, now described as hostile adversaries in court documents. Mills fired the first shot in court, filing a defamation lawsuit against Price on June 8th in Wake County, alleging that Price foiled the $500,000 investment by Shark Tank shark Kevin O'Leary. Price fired back October 18th with a suit that named Mills, Mills' husband Patrick Mills, his company Capital Sign Solutions, and the Wine and Design franchise as defendants, accusing them of locking her out of the franchise firm. It's unfortunate that after so much time has passed, we are revisiting a petty difference of opinions, Mills said. Price, through her attorney, declined to comment. It's just one of the Triangle's Shark Tank stories. Now here's what happened with three other Triangle entrepreneurs. For Y-Spots, Kevin Flannery, the Cary-based founder of Y-Spots, told Sharks in the 2009 premiere episode that he had taken out two mortgages to support his company, which created what he described as an interactive patient center. But the Sharks were taken aback by the product's $10,000 price tag and failed to invest. According to Flannery's LinkedIn profile, the firm lasted from 2002 to 2012, though a press release shows it merged with Worthington Healthcare Corporation after the episode aired. Flannery took on a new role with Alcatel-Lucent in 2012. As of March, his LinkedIn profile lists DTEL Engineering and Consultants as his employer, where he's Senior Vice President of Business Development and Operations. Then there's the firm Calix Technologies. Duke University-born Calix Technologies, a startup making comfortable sports bras, was unable to secure an investment on Shark Tank in 2009. The company was founded by former golfer and Duke University graduate Kimberly Casey, who later sold the firm to Activewear USA. Casey joined American University in 2017 as an adjunct professor and now teaches a graduate course on supporting female entrepreneurs in Pakistan. And finally, this third company is spelled strangely. It's EVREWARES, Sticky Ties. So perhaps Everywhere's Sticky Ties. So Everywhere's Sticky Ties turned down Mark Cuban's $200,000 offer to buy their company in 2015. Raleigh entrepreneurs Ellie Brown and Becca Nelson would say later it was tough going for the firm, which sold tie-shaped stickers. Brown and Nelson faced ridicule during the show, but walked away with a deal for their Raleigh company. When the cameras shut off, however, they ended up rejecting Cuban's offer to buy their company. And in the other large article on the technology page, under the heading of New Building, comes the article MetLife Plots Cary Expansion and a New Fund. MetLife has announced it will be adding 500 employees to its Cary headcount when its third building opens. But Dave DiTillo, Chief Information Officer for MetLife's U.S. business, points out that new jobs are only part of the story. MetLife is partnering with entrepreneurial advocate Techstars on a digital accelerator to occupy space in the new building. Details such as how many companies will be housed in the space are sparse. When you look at the digital accelerator specifically, it pairs the best of two worlds, DiTillo says. You'll have the incubation of innovative startup companies that will be here for 13 weeks, almost in a boot camp type setting, and we'll pair them up with MetLife experts in the same location that will coach and advise them as they look to understand what their needs are, DiTillo adds. In addition to fueling innovation, the company could potentially get in on the ground floor when it comes to industry-disrupting technologies. To complement that digital accelerator, MetLife has announced it's partnering with a yet-to-be-named venture capitalist firm on a $100 million fund. Now we move to the life sciences page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find two articles, one under the heading of New Company. Two former CRO execs launch new firm. Habergeon, a word for ancient armor, is the name former contract research organization executives Paula Brown Stafford and Lisa Grimes chose for their new company formed last year. Stafford says the idea is to get your armor on. The firm provides executive solutions, coaching, mentoring, workshops, and speaking engagements. Stafford was instrumental in the growth of Quintiles, now Quintiles IMS, since its beginnings in the 1980s. She served as its president of clinical development before departing in 2015. Stafford became an adjunct professor at the UNC Chapel Hill Gillings School of Global Public Health. She also currently serves as a board member and chief development officer of Novan, as well as Health Decisions. Grimes, currently president and CEO of PureThread, which specializes in antimicrobial textiles, spent the early years of her career as part of the executive management team at Wilmington-based Pharmaceutical Product Development, followed by roles as president and CEO of another CRO, Insight Clinical Trials, which was acquired by United Healthcare. She was also startup and interim CEO of a number of other companies in the life sciences field. She previously held positions at Glaxo, now GlaxoSmithKline, and served on an advisory board of Campbell Alliance, now part of INC Research. Stafford notes the idea for Habergeon largely centers around a book she and Grimes have co-authored, Remember Who You Are, which is scheduled for public release in March. Part of why we wanted to write the book was giving back, says Stafford, noting that she and Grimes have both been successful females in our industry and are STEM graduates from UNC. They both enjoy speaking together to audiences and coaching other women, she adds. While both Stafford and Grimes are committed to other companies currently, serving in executive roles, they continue to balance those commitments with the line of offerings at Habergeon. Stafford's role at Novan, as well as Grimes' role at PureThread, have not changed, Grimes said of running Habergeon. In terms of the types of clients Habergeon works with, those have spanned a number of industries, including healthcare, accounting, life sciences, and technology, as well as geographic locations, including the West Coast and New York, according to Stafford. Time frames for client work have spanned from single workshops to 3 to 6 month coaching commitments to 12-month executive solutions services, she said. Depending on varying client opportunities, we've been able to reach into our network to involve specific expertise as necessary on a case-by-case basis, Grimes says. That's the model that seems to be working well, she adds. Stafford says Habergeon is bringing in revenue in all of its core areas in 2017, though both she and Grimes declined to comment on any specific figures. And under the heading of Board Moves comes the article, Avista CEO recruited to join the board of Peregrine. Looking to transition from a research and development operation to a contract development and manufacturing organization, sometimes called CDMO, Peregrine Pharmaceuticals and wholly owned subsidiary Avid Bioservices have recruited Avista Pharma Solutions CEO Patrick Walsh as an independent member of their boards. Peregrine, based in Tustin, California, is looking to license or sell its research and development assets, according to the company, which includes lead immunotherapy candidate bavituximab. Walsh says Peregrine had undertaken a national search to add executives who had expertise in the contract services arena, and that he had also interacted with some of the executives at Abbott over the years. Peregrine is looking at the trends that the rest of the industry is seeing as well, Walsh says, which is a high degree of outsourcing when it comes to pharmaceutical and biotechnology clients. The company has built up offerings in contract services and is seeing a significant growth curve there, he adds. In terms of joining two boards of companies focused in the CDMO space like Avista, Walsh says, there's no competitive overlap between what Avista does and what Avid does. Peregrine and Avid, as well as Avista, are keen on growth. Avista recently completed a lab expansion in Durham as it looks to add between 75 and 100 new employees in the next 12 to 24 months. Over the last month, Walsh says Avista has extended more than 20 offers, largely for scientific and technical roles, including process chemistry. Also on the Life Sciences page comes the article entitled, Heat Subsidiary Lands Another $6.5 Million. Pelican Therapeutics, a subsidiary of Durham-based Heat Biologics, is moving forward with a second $6.5 million tranche of a $15.2 million grant from the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas, sometimes called CPRIT. We've acknowledged the latest set of milestones, and now we've gotten the money to achieve the next set of milestones as well, says Jeff Wolf, founder and CEO of Heat Biologics. Pelican is developing two product candidates, an antibody known as PTX35 and a fusion protein known as PTX15, designed to stimulate and proliferate certain T cells in cancer patients when it comes to immunotherapy treatment. To date, Pelican has received $8.3 million in CPRIT funding. The company received the first tranche of its $15.2 million grant earlier this year for bringing its product candidates to the point where they're optimized and ready for manufacture, Wolf says. Pelican's next milestones will involve the manufacture of the products and adding staff to support those efforts. Now we move to the page called Law Quarterly. And the first article is Shanahan's Law Firm Eyeing Growth. Raleigh's Shanahan Law Group, founded by former federal prosecutor Kieran Shanahan back in 2001, has hung a new shingle. With the addition of a second named partner, Greg McDougall, the 12-attorney law firm has changed its name to Shanahan McDougall and is eyeing more growth in the near future, according to Shanahan. I opened the firm 17 years ago, and we pride ourselves in being a boutique, he says. All the partners come from big firm backgrounds and fundamentally feel that being smaller and more nimble allows us to work for our clients rather than the firm. But he adds, we've seen the demand grow quickly, and it just became time to grow so that we could service our clients better. McDougall, with whom Shanahan originally connected through a mutual hobby of hunting, joins the firm from Alston and Byrd, and was also previously a partner at Kilpatrick, Townsend, and Stockton. Both prior firms have offices across the U.S. and abroad. The firm also has brought on two new associates, H. Denton Worrell and Nathaniel Pencook. From a business point of view, consumers of legal services are becoming more sophisticated, and they're shopping for services, says Shanahan, who, aside from a brief leave of absence in 2013, to serve as the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Public Safety under former Governor Pat McCrory, has remained active in practicing at the helm of his firm. It's about balancing strong client service with a certain comfort level in numbers of attorneys and resources, he says, noting alternative fee arrangements, including fixed fees, blended fees, and contingency fees, have also been an important component of the firm's operations to date. Now, Shanahan McDougall will be looking to continue to expand. Specifically, he said, he expects the firm to grow its community banking practice, as well as commercial development and general corporate practices. Early next year, we're probably going to have another round of growth, Shanahan said. And under the heading of Legal Help is the article, 1 year in, Campbell Community Law Clinic looking to grow. 1 year after opening in downtown Raleigh, the Campbell Community Law Clinic, which offers pro bono legal services to people facing challenges in areas such as housing and employment, is looking to grow. The Community Law Clinic, which got off the ground with a $150,000 grant from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, originally partnered with Raleigh Rescue Mission, Urban Ministries of Wake County, and Step Up Ministry in order for the local nonprofits to refer clients in need. And now the clinic has brought on a fourth partner, Alliance Medical Ministry, whose executive director, Meg Rader, is a graduate of Campbell Law School. The clinic's home is the Horton Beckham Brech House at 11 South Blunt Street. We've handled approximately 100 cases since we opened our doors in September of 2016, says Ashley Campbell, director of the clinic and a partner at Ragsdale Liggett. She says the clinic realized that we have the capacity to take on another partner. The Community Law Clinic has 8 third-year law students register for a 3-credit course each semester, through which they assist clients referred to the clinic. We're also in the process of building a roster of volunteer lawyers who are able and willing to take cases when not appropriate for our students, Campbell says. The Community Law Clinic is currently raising money aimed at creating a robust lawyer referral program to allow us to take on even more partners, she adds. Now we turn to the page A Better World, and on that page is the article, Art Groups Get a Boost from Rising Lawyers. Artists and art groups in the Triangle wanting to hold pop-up events and property owners with available space can turn to a pop-up toolkit prepared with the help of law students at UNC Chapel Hill. The toolkit spells out logistics and details of planning and staging the events, from permits and insurance to rules on access to parking and restrooms. Emerging arts leaders who want to increase their revenue through more effective use of marketing, social media, fundraising, and other functions can attend monthly workshops, while photographers, filmmakers, writers, and other creative artists can learn about copyright law and other legal issues on monthly talks put on by lawyers. Spearheading all those efforts is Triangle Artworks, a nonprofit formed in 2010 that aims to serve as an advocate for the region's arts community. We're working to make it easier for artists and arts organizations and businesses to thrive, which is good for the entire Triangle, not just the artists, says Beth Yorksa, executive director and co-founder of Triangle Artworks. When she chaired the Raleigh Arts Commission in the 2000, Yorksa saw a gap in resources and infrastructure for the region's arts community. Lawyers, in comparison, can turn to county, state, and national bar associations for professional development and other resources, says Yorksa, a lawyer. So she helped launch Triangle Artworks, an all-volunteer nonprofit that operates with an annual budget of $10,000 and 30 to 40 active volunteers. The group serves artists and art groups, both nonprofit and for-profit, in Chatham, Durham, Johnston, Orange, and Wake counties. With $10,000 in grants, it's been building its organizational infrastructure, including development of its board and raising money. The arts enrich our lives, Yorksa says. The arts create jobs and our jobs. Artists are innovators. If the Triangle is building itself as a technology and innovative community, the arts need to be part of that. Now we turn to the Around the State page, and there are two articles here. The first on healthcare. Florida firm wins bid for Morehead over UNC Health. As rural hospitals across the U.S. struggle to stay open, Morehead Memorial Hospital has taken steps in the past year to keep its doors open, and now the Eden facility believes it may have found a solution, a new owner. Morehead Memorial has been searching for a healthcare organization it could join forces with since 2016, in hopes a partnership places the floundering hospital on the path of financial stability. Realizing its debt presented an obstacle toward finding a partner, the hospital filed a Chapter 11 petition in July, and as a result of the bankruptcy proceedings, Morehead Memorial has found an organization willing to take over. This week, an offer by Empower IHCC, a little-known company based in Miami, was selected by Morehead Memorial's Board of Trustees as a successful bid during an auction for the hospital's assets, beating out organizations such as Cone Health and UNC Healthcare. I don't think there's a hospital in the United States that feels like they are out of the woods simply because the healthcare industry has become increasingly complex, increasingly challenging, says Dana Weston, Chief Executive Officer of Morehead Memorial. The reality is that with a partner, with Empower, Morehead now has a better chance to survive well into the future than we have had in recent history. Morehead Memorial, which employs almost 700 people, has 108 acute care beds and operates Morehead Nursing Center, a 121-bed facility. Few details have been revealed about Empower's bid for Morehead Memorial, as well as those made by 6 other organizations vying for the hospital's assets. But Morehead Memorial fielded bids for both individual assets and the hospital's entire assets. One of the entities bidding, First Citizens Bank in Raleigh, placed a bid because hospital property collateralizes a bank loan. Cone Health says it placed an offer for our select assets, but did not disclose details. Liberty Healthcare Management in Wilmington says it placed a bid for Morehead Nursing Center. Novant Health, which has managed Morehead Memorial since 2014, did not bid. Empower's bids was for all of Morehead Memorial's assets. A hearing will be held on November the 6th for a bankruptcy judge to decide whether to approve the offer. And under the heading of commercial development comes the article, Development Plan for Swath of Land Near Carowinds. A swath of land along the Carolinas border and immediately north of Carowinds appears to be pegged for development. The 24.2-acre parcel at 14523 Carowinds Boulevard was rezoned by Carowinds earlier this year from I-2, which permits general industrial uses, to I-1, a light industrial zoning designation that allows a wide range of commercial development, including amusement uses, manufacturing, recreation centers measuring up to 30,000 square feet, hotels and motels, laboratories up to 400,000 square feet of office space, and as much as 70,000 square feet of retail development. The zoning petition filed with the city was a conventional request, meaning details about the development, including site plans and renderings, were not included in the application. Conventional requests are not tied to any specific uses or proposal. Also recently filed with the City Planning Department, an application for a project called Spring Hill Suites Carowinds at the same parcel that was rezoned by Carowinds in September. A Carowinds spokeswoman declined to elaborate on any planned development or confirm Spring Hill Suites' involvement in the project. The rezoned parcel on Carowinds Boulevard is currently undeveloped. Carowinds owns the land, according to Mecklenburg County real estate records. Carowinds parent company, Cedar Fair of Sandusky, Ohio, purchased the land in 2011 for $810,000. Carowinds, a 400-acre amusement park on the border of North and South Carolina, saw 2 million visitors last year, according to this year's list of top local tourist attractions by Charlotte Business Journal. Cedar Fair owns and operates 11 amusement parks, 2 outdoor water parks, 1 indoor water park, and 5 hotels. Now we turn to the cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that cover story is entitled, Hello, Investors. Life Sciences Ecosystem Begs for Capital. For G1 Therapeutics, 2017 brought an initial public offering of more than $108 million. G1 spun out of UNC Chapel Hill in 2008 and got a lift in its early years with a $3 million federal grant and $500,000 from the North Carolina Biotechnology Center in 2011 and 2012. Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partners signed on in 2012. But even that wasn't enough funding, and the company began pursuing out-of-state investors to participate in its Series A, B, and C rounds of approximately $12 million, $30 million, and $50 million, respectively. Those investors included MedImmune Ventures, RA Capital Healthcare Fund, and Lumira Capital. Mark Velica, CEO of the Research Triangle Park-based company, says securing the first round of funding is tough for an early-stage life sciences company and requires a wide net. But he says that's what airlines are for. G1 is a rare case. In the Triangle, there simply aren't many similar success stories when it comes to funding in the life sciences field, despite the region being seen as a hotbed for breakthrough research. Very, very few people in the state are interested in talking about investing in life sciences biotech startups and subsequent funding rounds, says Frank Sorge, who runs his oncology drug development company, Flag Therapeutics, from his Raleigh office. I'm always flying out when I'm having investment-related conversations. Many life sciences industry observers voiced that to get the funding spigot wide open, the Triangle must also become known for producing tried-and-true business leaders for the companies looking to push products forward. Bringing a drug to market takes massive amounts of money. In fact, the cost to develop a new drug is often more than $2 billion. The path to approval, with rounds of expensive clinical trials, is complicated and risky, and investors want to make sure they put their dollars in the right hands. An analysis of funding by Triangle Business Journal's parent, American City Business Journals, sometimes called by the acronym ACBJ, shows that since 2007, only about 27% of funding for Triangle-based companies has come from investors inside the state. And local life sciences companies, when looking to reel in out-of-state funds, face intense scrutiny when it comes to lack of geographic proximity that provides a sense of security for investors, familiarity with leadership, and track records of success. Joe Nixon, who until recently was Vice President of Business and Technology Development of NC Biotech, says the result is a very significant funding gap through the early stages of development. Life sciences companies in their early stages, in the Triangle and beyond, require massive amounts of funding. With pharmaceutical companies looking at the human market, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more, to move a product to market, says Jennifer Giordano Coldpart of Kilpatrick, Townsend, and Stockton. Bioscience venture capital investments from 2012 to 2015 were about $1.26 billion in North Carolina, compared to about $9.48 billion in Massachusetts and $19.16 billion in California, according to Techonomy Bio's The Value of Bioscience Innovation in Growing Jobs and Improving Quality of Life 2016. In comparison to federal NIH funding, which the Triangle historically been successful in landing, venture-backed dollars are hard to get. In terms of total NIH funding in 2016 alone, North Carolina ranked sixth in the nation with more than $1.15 billion, according to data compiled by ACBJ. California placed first with roughly $3.69 billion in NIH funding last year. A number of universities, including Duke University, UNC Chapel Hill, and NC State University, hover at the top of the list of North Carolina recipients, which also includes the likes of contract research organizations Roe and PPD, as well as Durham-based pharmaceutical company BioCryst. The capital required to complete clinical trials is large, and so later rounds lend themselves to larger dollar amounts, says Larry Robbins of Raleigh law firm Wyrick, Robbins, Yates, and Ponton. He adds that because the public markets have not been that receptive to IPOs, the investment community has stepped in to fill that gap. Accordingly, Series D, E, and F rounds, for instance, are substantially equivalent in terms of the size of what used to be a great IPO, Robbins said. But making money in life sciences is not easy or quick. For investors, that money can be tied up for years before there's any sign of return. Aside from time and money, there's also a level of complexity when it comes to life sciences companies' quest for capital. These companies must attract a sophisticated investor, one capable of understanding their technologies. The real tough question from entrepreneurs and investors in not just our market but all markets is distinguishing between a science project that could evolve at some point in time to something that can be seen as a sustainable enterprise that can draw money, says Art Pappas, founder and managing partner at Pappas Ventures. In life sciences, the therapeutic sector is far more complex than the medical device sector. Developing a drug and putting it in front of the FDA is a totally different scenario than, for example, developing a Class 1 device requiring the least amount of regulatory hoop jumping. Devices are easier to understand, easier to get approved, and require less time and money overall. While the Triangle is a hub for life sciences companies, that's simply not the case for venture capital firms. Historically, there have just been a handful, and that number has dwindled recently with InterSouth Partners and Aurora no longer making new investments. That leaves Hatteras Venture Partners and Pappas Ventures alone in making new investments. If we look at the big picture and compare North Carolina to what is happening in Boston or San Francisco, in those areas there's a very high level of native capital venture capital groups and other funding groups that are providing large levels of funding, Nixon says. Any company with a good platform has capital scale available locally that they can draw on. Here we have a relative dearth of early-stage life sciences venture capital. There's a very limited group providing that, he says. As a result, there's a need throughout companies' life cycles. This area needs more venture capital, says Bob Ingram, general partner at Hatteras Venture Partners. It would be great, not just for the capital itself, but the brand of our market, if we could attract a Kleiner or somebody like that to open an office here and be part of the ecosystem here. For local life sciences companies developing drugs, there are essentially three sources of capital: federal grants, NC Biotech, and venture capital. The first two sources come in at the very early stages of research, while venture capital provides the fuel to move trials and the regulatory approval process forward. Since there aren't many venture capital groups in the Triangle, this last source requires looking out of state. In Boston, for instance, there are at least 100 venture capital firms. That's not the case in the Triangle. The possibilities for additional venture capital groups setting up shop locally could come from a firm from outside the area opening an office locally, a member of a local group spinning off on his or her own, or recruiting someone from outside the area to start a new fund, explains Nixon, the former NC Biotech exec, who's now Vice President of Business Development for Locus Biosciences. Regardless, to get up and running, it would take some time, several fund cycles, before raising $100 million, for instance, he says. With a small number of venture capital groups locally and the high dollars needed to get drugs to market, Triangle Life Sciences companies are looking elsewhere. The bigger checks are coming from outside the area, Robbins says. But these high-dollar checks can be hard to come by in terms of luring out-of-state investors, and they might come with a significant loss of local presence and control. Many times, it comes down to well-connected, seasoned entrepreneurs leading a new company, which eases investors' minds when it comes to lack of geographic proximity and close oversight. Venture capital groups, concentrated on the West Coast and in the Northeast, like to fund things close to home, says serial entrepreneur Richard Sherwitt, CEO of Durham diagnostics company Syngenix. Our company was funded by angel investors initially, but to do that, you really have to have a good network of people. He adds, "This is my third venture. I'm pretty well connected, and I was able to raise the money to get off the ground. Now we're going to need to go to the next level, and that's probably going to require institutional funding." Venture capital investors will go back to where they've seen success before and have had established relationships. If there's been a positive experience, that tends to be where the money is going to flood, says Bill Pappas of Parker, Poe, and Adams and Bernstein, no relation to Art Pappas. Robbins says many life science companies are remaining in university systems longer because of the challenge of finding funding. Things like safety and efficacy are, in many cases, being performed in university labs, where 10 years ago those companies might have spun out and done the same things in independent corporations, he said. Sometimes, when they leave the university setting, they wind up leaving the Triangle. Anytime a company is raising money from investors, there is some ceding of control, whether that be through stock, giving up a percentage of the company, or bringing new members onto a board. For example, Aerie Pharmaceuticals, a Duke University spinout that is well on its way to potential FDA approval of its eye drop product for the treatment of glaucoma, now calls California and New Jersey its corporate locations. The company continues to beef up its research and development team, which remains based in Durham. Sally Shuping Russell, Managing Director of BlackRock Private Equity Partners, says a challenge for the Triangle is finding people who can execute the plan, deliver the product, and make profits. The Triangle needs more proven management teams, echoes Ingram, one that can develop a product and bring it to market. While the Triangle is the contract research organization capital of the world and is known internationally for leadership in that space, leadership talent in terms of life sciences companies developing drugs and devices is not at the same scale. The bigger problem for us is that we'll get great companies started and then they'll be acquired and leave here and become known for being developed in another part of the country, says Shuping Russell. We need to be known for building great companies. If you build great companies, capital is going to come. In terms of how the Triangle fares nationally when looking at a funding gap, it sits in a second group, according to Nixon. While areas such as Boston and San Francisco rise to the top of the list, states such as Kansas, Ohio, and Virginia, for instance, have even less than North Carolina. But what can the Triangle and its companies do to address the funding gap that exists? Nixon says there are three things companies need in order to get funded: great technology, great management, and some money to get started. If companies have two of the three items, they can usually get the third, he says. But with only one of the three, it's very hard. Money is the limiting factor, he says, but that's tied in part to leadership. We don't have enough experience and serial entrepreneurs who have been successful and are coming back to do it again. Pappas of Pappas Ventures agrees, saying the triangle needs leadership to move the science concept into a commercial concept. Robbins, for example, says, if we could duplicate the depth of management that the CRO community has in therapeutics and diagnostics, that would make a huge difference. Robbins' sentiments reflect the general notion about the large presence of several large CROs in the area. After Quintiles led the way in the 1970s, companies such as PRA Health, INC Research, Parexel, Roe, and scores of other companies employ thousands of scientists, researchers, and C-level executives who are traveling I-40 and I-440 every day. As G1's Velika says, I think you need to articulate the value proposition of why you're in North Carolina. Being here provides access to talent known for drug development, low facility costs like rent, and the ability to recruit from across the U.S. and globally, he adds. Investors want to hear that their dollars are going to go farther in North Carolina, Velika says. We haven't had any investors say, when are you going to move? Now, in connection with this cover story article comes a graph showing life sciences funding in the Triangle. And in this graph, there are the 15 largest deals in the Triangle since 2007. So I'll simply read the name of the company, the approximate date, and the amount of money. So there's Humacyte in October of 15 for $150 million. Phononic in November of 16 for $71 million. Tier Science in February of 13 for $70 million. Humacyte, January of 15 for $62.8 million. Viamet Pharmaceuticals, October of 14 for $60 million. Argos Therapeutics, also $60 million in November of 13. Biolex Therapeutics in October of 2008, $60 million. There's Transenterix, December of 11, $55 million. NetPower, June of 2012, for $50.4 million. G1 Therapeutics, in July of 16, that's $50 million. Interpulse, January of 07, for $50 million. Also at $50 million, Argos Therapeutics, in April of 12. And Clinipace Worldwide, in January of 15. And Research Triangle Park, in October of 15. And finally, the 15th company is Novan, in March of 2015 at $50 million. Now, frequent listeners to this program know that there's always an executive voice column interviewing one of the executives from the local area, and today's is no exception, and they're interviewing Sonia Hobson. And Sonia is the CEO of Hire Strategies. That's H-I-R-E, Hire Strategies. Sonia has a bachelor's in accounting and finance from Fayetteville State University and an MBA from Strayer. Her first job was with T. Rowe Price in Baltimore. She's a 20-year veteran of the staffing industry. Sonia Hobson hung out her own shingle in late 2013. Since then, she's grown her firm, Hire Strategies, to about a dozen full-time employees that staff up to 200 people per day on average. Her firm is certified as North Carolina Historically Underutilized Business and focuses primarily on the manufacturing, construction, and office administration sectors. So, here are the Q&A questions for Sonia Hobson. When and why did you choose the staffing industry as a career? Early in my career, I determined that being in roles that allowed me to foster relationships with clients and assist them with their business challenges by providing software solutions or meeting their needs as it relates to supplemental labor provided great satisfaction for me. I thoroughly enjoyed working in the staffing industry. It provides me the ability to interact with various clients and industries. More importantly, it gives me the opportunity to help others find meaningful employment and identify careers that coincided with their interests and ability. So just why did you choose to focus on just a few specific industries at Hire Strategies? When the economy shifted in 2008, I transitioned from manufacturing staffing to providing skilled trade labor for the construction industry. I've been able to establish and foster sustainable relationships throughout the years, and ironically, Those were the clients who transitioned with me as I formed Hire Strategies. They provided support to me and trusted me to aid their companies with supplemental labor on various commercial and industrial projects throughout North Carolina. They have not only been my business partners, but also resources that I've used for advice and ways to improve my business and become even more of a resource when the opportunity to supplement their workforces arise. So what's the biggest challenge you've had to face in your current business? Probably the fear that comes with getting started altogether, telling myself that I wasn't ready, it was too much for me, and so on. So I learned to put the negative voices in my head behind me and move on to do what I knew I was capable of doing and what I had been prepared to do by the grace of God. So what are your short and long-term business goals for your business? To continue to grow and expand my business by opening additional locations in North Carolina and South Carolina, which will allow me to serve an even greater need for skilled trade outside of the local area. So what's the best piece of advice you've been given? To hire those around you who have the expertise and knowledge that you lack, to have more than one banking relationship, and to identify and retain top talent. So what advice would you give women in the workforce today? To follow your heart and follow your dreams and not let anyone or anything deter you from your goals. Have confidence and take risks. What you do not know, you have the ability to learn from others, mentors, business partnerships, and local organizations that provide support to entrepreneurs. You've been referred to as the lady in the pink hard hat. How did that come about? When I first started in construction staffing, I would spend a lot of time on construction sites, either providing temp labor or meeting with clients. Of course, one of the requirements was that I wear a hard hat and proper PPE. I did not like the white hard hat and would often try to get away with not wearing it. So my first construction client, Bonson Mechanical, purchased a pink hard hat for me so I could conform to the safety requirements of the job sites, and I began to wear it with pride on every job site. I became known as the Pink Hard Hat Lady, and it began to have brand recognition. The pink hard hat has become a symbol of our core values: safety, quality, excellence, and integrity. So what keeps you up at night? Focusing on the company strategy, our goals for the next year, 5 years, 10 years. Also, how to challenge ourselves to be better than we were yesterday. Developing and growing my staff professionally and personally, and going above and beyond to meet the expectations of our internal and external clients. Lastly, what books are currently on your nightstand? Traction by Gino Wickman, Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller, and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Now we turn to the small business page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the article is Change Looms in World of Convertible Preferred Stock. The author of this article is Jim Verdonik. He's an attorney at Ward & Smith, PA in Raleigh, and the author of Crowdfunding, A Legal Guide to Investment and Platform Regulations. We're used to having choices, sometimes too many choices. But there were few choices in the world of technology company finance. If you wanted to raise money, you had to sell convertible preferred stock. The National Venture Capital Association even posted standard convertible preferred stock deal documents on their website. For several decades, VC finance was the equivalent of a sandwich shop asking you whether you want white bread or white bread. Convertible preferred stock dominated for a remarkably long time. The current form of documents originated at the beginning of the modern venture capital industry in the 1970s. Only incremental changes have been made since then. In 2017, however, companies have raised more than $3 billion in coin offerings. Who knows what the total will be by year end? Will coins replace convertible preferred stock? Probably not. But the rise of coins signals that convertible preferred stock is no longer the single dominant financial instrument. Several primary factors are driving change. 1. Different businesses need different solutions. 2. Crowdfunding laws and technology are bringing new investors into the market. Traditional VC firms are no longer the only viable financing source. 3. IPOs are less realistic as an exit strategy than they once were. And finally, 4. VC finance is going global. Let's examine how these factors are changing investment instruments. The first change came to bridge loans. Convertible preferred stock deals create several inches of paperwork and $50,000 plus in combined legal fees for investors and companies. Bridge loans were initially ways to finance businesses that were already negotiating with a VC. They morphed into inexpensive ways to finance businesses for a year or two until the business could raise permanent financing. Next, limited liability companies that initially were limited to small businesses and holding passive investments became popular with growth companies and early stage investors for tax reasons. Initially, VC firms would not invest in LLCs. That began to change over a decade ago. Next came SAFEs, Simple Agreements for Future Equity. SAFEs started as more issuer-friendly instruments than bridge loans, but in crowdfunding, offerings became a way to keep small investors outside the normal cap table for many years until the company is sold. Special Purchase Vehicles, SPVs, perform the same functions in Rule 506C offerings. SAFEs then evolved to KISSes, that's Keep It Simple Security, which are a more investor-friendly instrument than SAFEs. Crowdfunding popularized revenue share notes. These debt securities provide businesses with flexible repayment terms based on a percentage of monthly revenue and generally don't require security interests and assets, personal guarantees, or financial covenants. In return, businesses pay higher effective interest rates than banks charge. Then, of course, coins and tokens spread when blockchain software helped early-stage finance go global. Investors wanted ways to get in and out of investments quickly and wanted to avoid government attention. Businesses wanted ways to raise money without burdensome security laws. Of course, governments never ignore anything for long. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission decided that some tokens or coins are securities. China banned coins trading, and other countries created different regulatory frameworks. When security regulations became inevitable, SAFTs were invented, that's Simple Agreement for Future Tokens. SAFTs are sold as securities through crowdfunding securities exemptions, but businesses will argue that the tokens investors later receive are not securities because of their functionality. What's next, you ask? I'm creating new blockchain-based investment instruments called SALOs. What are SALOs? Call me to find out. Once again, that's Jim Verdonik, an attorney at Ward & Smith PA in Raleigh. And toward the end of the program, as you know, every week we read Viewpoint. That always contains an article from the editor's notebook, and this week is no exception. And this week's article is called, In Biotech, Access to Capital Heads the Wrong Way. Reporter Jennifer Henson's in-depth look at the disconnect between research and venture capital in the life sciences industry should have every Triangle resident worried. At a time when Wall Street is hitting new highs almost every day, and capital continues to remain cheap in the broader market, the struggle to raise money for Triangle Life Sciences Company has gotten worse. While the story points out that we simply do not have much gunpowder at the local level, that is, just 27% rather of the money in the life sciences sector came from local investors in the past decade, there are some trends emerging that could make the potent local university research community pack its bags and move where the money is. Well, that may be a slight exaggeration, but you get the point. Why work on your research here when you know the chances of being funded in the later stages will be difficult? The four biggest venture capital players in the life sciences space, New Enterprise Associates, Flagship Pioneering, Third Rock Ventures, and Arch Venture Partners, are not much of a factor in the Triangle scene. So, who is? For years, the two largest late-stage investors in the local area have been Pappas Ventures and InterSouth Ventures. InterSouth is folding its tent and will not raise money for any additional funds. That leaves us with Pappas Ventures, which in 2015 was ranked 78 among the top 100 VCs investing in the biotech field, according to Endpoint News, a digital aggregator of investment data. In 2016, it did not make the top 100. This dearth of capital in the local market may soon cost a triangle, in the form of life sciences startups coming out of local universities. Aerie Pharmaceuticals, a clinical-stage drug company spun out of Duke University, decided to move its corporate headquarters to California in search of forging relationships with the investment community. Raleigh's Flag Therapeutics already has indicated it will move operations to where the money is to develop its oncology research, and there will be more. We need zest and vigor from the life sciences stalwarts in this community to come up with a master plan to start building bridges with the money people. It does not look like having an annual venture conference or a life sciences summit is the solution. Conference organizers say VCs are coming to the RTP area in droves to listen to the new pitches from the life sciences community. Maybe, but they aren't doing much investing. Could this mean the research itself may be hard to commercialize? That's where the universities come in. And let's not forget all the National Institutes of Health dollars that go into research grants, that is, taxpayers' money. When a company fails, all of us lose. It's time to wake up. And frequent listeners know that on the Viewpoint page, there's the ACBJ Business Survey Pulse. And there's always a question. And the question this week is, which technology will have the greatest impact on your business? Now, there were 439 responses in this week's poll. So, 37% believe it's artificial intelligence. 17% say other. 13% says robotics. 11% say virtual and augmented reality. 10% self-driving vehicles. Drones, 6%. And wearables, 6%. And there are a couple of people on the move, so here we have a new hire, Catherine Cady King, a litigation associate with Everett Gaskins Hancock, LLP. Julie Powers, a new hire at Managing Director of Strategic Staffing Services, Computer Task Group. There's a new hire, John High, Managing Director at West and Woodall Commercial Real Estate. And a couple of promotions, Sean McCartney, Engineering Manager for Holocene Clean Energy. And another promotion, Ben Moulton, Manager of Finance and Development, also at Holocene Clean Energy. And finally, to close this week's Triangle Business Journal program, comes a quote from Stacy McIntyre, founder and president and CEO of Durham's Veritas Collaborative on raising just north of $8.7 million. This investment will support our efforts to continue to fill a gap in services for individuals with eating disorders. Our next big focus is the development of a new hospital in Atlanta with 50 pediatric acute care psychiatric beds dedicated to the treatment of eating disorders. We're excited to meet the needs of the Atlanta community and will use this funding to support our ongoing growth throughout the Southeast. So we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 832-5138.